From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported that this past winter was the warmest in the 121 years of record keeping. Warmest ever. More than 4 degrees above average in the U.S. A lot of people want to try to do something about that, about climate change. Despite being in a time of super low oil and gas prices, many are turning to solar. It's booming. This hour on Point, the how and why now of a solar energy boom. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you solar paneled up? Why? How's it working? And do you see a game changer here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we will look at Elon Musk and Warren Buffett battling over solar. But first, the sound of this warm winter. Throw your mind back to December. Temperatures in Buffalo, New York. No tropical paradise in most winters, but they were so warm that the NBC affiliate there, WGRZ, spotted a water skier dressed as Santa Claus out on the river.
Warm enough to be out on the water. Our camera's catching Santa Claus. He was doing just that. Here's the guy out on the Niagara River today, the jolly old elf himself, spotted water skiing.
And here, just last Wednesday, the weather report from New York City, where there were record-breaking temperatures across the northeastern U.S., meteorologist John Elliott from CBS New York talked about the weather on March 9th.
We are looking at a normal high for the 29th of May, so it feels like May 29th. There's another way to kind of put it in perspective. 74 today in the city is the normal high you'd expect for this day in Daytona Beach, and you didn't even have to pack.
Feeling like late May in early March, and for some people, here's the answer, the sound of solar panels being installed. Up they go in San Diego, California. Joining me first today from Seattle, Washington, is David Roberts. He reports on energy and climate for Vox.com. David, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Record high winter temperatures. Is there any question that this is a global climate change effect?
I think at this point that question has more or less been settled.
And at the same time, we have the lowest fossil fuel energy prices that people can remember in years and years. And yet solar, I mean, wind is out there too. We'll look at that another day. But solar is booming. I'm reading here they're projecting that U.S. solar installations will more than double this year, up 119%. Why, at a time of super low natural gas and heating oil, and all the rest on the fossil fuel front, why is solar booming, David?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, but the main driving factor that's behind all of this is the extraordinary drop in prices in solar panels. I mean, solar panels have come down in prices 70% just since 2009. And that, you know, that figure is from last year. So literally, when it comes to the price of solar, you literally need months-old numbers, or else you're out of date. Things are happening so fast. So panels have just become extraordinarily cheap, and so that's made it much cheaper to put it up on your rooftop, and it's made it much, much cheaper to build big solar plants.
Why are those panels, why have they come down so dramatically in price?
Well, the main reason for that is China. Germany started its big green energy transition and created an enormous amount of demand for solar panels, and China started manufacturing them. And once China scaled up its manufacturing, and also China heavily subsidized its manufacturing of those panels for several years. So, and then China scaled that manufacturing up to such an enormous degree that it just, there's learning by doing. There were economies of scale, things just and silicon actually, after going through a little bit of a supply bump a few years ago, has become copious again. So it's all coming together. And then alongside that, all the other parts of getting solar installed are also getting cheaper, although not quite as fast. And that means customer acquisition costs, operation and maintenance, all the sort of workaday details of making these panels and plants work. business models, all those things are coming along as well.
I want to look in detail at all of that. It's really interesting. I'm looking at a piece just, this is in the Boston Globe over the weekend, saying that in spite of these super low oil and gas prices, we've got global investments in clean energy hitting $329 billion last year, up again from 2014. U.S. investments up even more, up 7.6%, and saying it's no longer just a boutique industry with little experimental companies. They call it a rapidly maturing sector going big time fast instead of startups, says the Boston Globe, with possibility the bulk of the money, nearly two-thirds of global clean energy investment, going to utility-scale projects, particularly solar and wind, that can generate power for tens of thousands of homes. So this isn't just, there's a lot of panels on home rooftops, but it's also on grand scale, David.
Yes, actually, most people, I think, are more familiar with solar panels on rooftops, probably because that's what they see when they drive around, and that's what gets a lot of the press these days. But actually, the utility-scale solar power plant sector, there's more solar installed in those solar power plants, and there's more capacity being added from big power plants than from rooftop. It's actually the big solar power plant that is the workhorse of solar power.
Where are those going in? In what parts of the country most heavily, and in what kind of locations?
Well, I mean, they can go in a surprisingly wide array of places, because the thing about solar power, which is very distinct from, say, a giant coal plant or a giant nuclear plant, is it's incredibly scalable. You can make a solar power plant that's 10 megawatts, 100 megawatts, a gigawatt, 2 gigawatts. It's just a matter
of adding
more panels.
Mm-hmm.
So you can squeeze them. They're being squeezed in everywhere, especially in California, where you know the combination of low prices and a lot of incentives has really created sort of a hyper boom in this. You know, they're just tucking them anywhere there's a piece of empty land near a power line. Obviously, you need a certain minimum level of sunlight, but you can put them almost anywhere. And of course, there's the really big plants are going in the southwestern desert.
Now, you talked about subsidies in China that have helped bring down the price of solar panels. But what about subsidies here and how important they are? State subsidies, federal subsidies. I mean, as much as those solar panels have come down in price, oil has also dropped radically in price. Are subsidies what's keeping everything afloat? And I thought they were going away. I guess they didn't.
Well, it depends on what subsidies you mean. There's an array of subsidies that boosted solar in the U.S. in its early days. And what's happening now is you're watching them slowly phase out. So, for instance, a lot of states have renewable energy mandates. They tell their utilities you have to build a certain minimum percentage of renewable energy into your mix. And so for a long time, those renewable energy mandates were what was driving these big solar plants. Utilities had to build them, basically, by law.
Okay.
But a new report just came out a couple of days ago that said that next year, 2016, for the first time ever, more than half of utility-scale solar plants are being built outside those mandates. So you can sort of see the industry starting to outgrow those mandates. Now, the tax credits, which were a really hard-fought big deal late last year.
This is for individual homeowners, you mean?
Well, there's two. There's one for wind, and there's one called the investment tax credit for solar, and it's mostly for big solar.
Okay.
So that got extended for 5 years. It's going to phase out now in the U.S. over the course of the next 5 years. But if you ask a solar CEO, somebody in the business, they say, "Look, our eyes are already beyond subsidies. We already have a plan toward profitability without subsidies within 5 years. Nobody, I don't think, at this point is worried anymore about the subsidies going away."
You paint a picture for individual homeowners of what they call net metering being very important. We're going to talk about Elon Musk and Warren Buffett duking it out in Nevada later in the hour, but this idea that you can generate power off the panels at your home and sell it back to the utility, how big a driver has that been?
That has been a huge driver, and that remains incredibly important to the industry, which is why all these fights that are going on state by state all over the country, not just Nevada, but I think there are something like 20 states now where there are ongoing fights between utilities, which are trying to scale back net metering, and solar homeowners who have now become numerous enough, and the companies that sell solar have become big enough now that they're a substantial lobbying force at this point, which is why a lot of these battles are getting so so vicious. But yeah, what happens is if you put solar panels on your roof and you generate more than you use, the utility is obliged to buy that excess power from you at retail rates as opposed to wholesale rates, which is what they pay big power plants for power.
Mm-hmm.
You, they pay retail rates. And what the utilities say is, look, you're zeroing out your electricity bill, but you're still using the grid. You're still using the grid as backup. You're still using our resources. You're still using us to come repair your power lines when they go down, but you're not paying for any of that. So what you're doing is offloading those common costs onto non-solar homeowners. That's the utility perspective. And, of course, solar homeowners see it differently. And, that's as you see in Nevada, how that turns out can make an enormous difference for the industry. Like, the solar industry is fleeing Nevada as we speak.
We're going to look at that. We're going to look at the cost for individual homeowners of putting this in. Of course, many now leasing and often with zero upfront costs.
Yeah, that's right.
How big a difference can this make over time? I mean, it's only 1% of the nation's electricity generation. Even with this booming growth, they're talking about some estimates 3.5% by 2020. You know, still, it sounds like pretty small beans.
Well, it is. It is still fairly small beans, and it's starting. You have to remember. I mean, two things to remember. One is the amount of power the U.S. uses is just gargantuan. So it makes a really.
Mm-hmm.
You need a lot of power to make a difference in that. And two, it's just starting from a really small base. So, but I think we've seen, it doesn't take much exponential growth before you start seeing numbers that scare utilities. And the other thing to note about that is solar cuts in to what's called peak power. So power demand tends to spike at predictable times in the middle of the day. And that's when the utilities make a lot of their money, because that peak power is the most expensive sort of power. They fire up the most expensive power plants.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about solar energy booming in the warmest winter on record, even with the lowest oil prices in years. David Roberts is with us. He reports on energy and climate for Vox.com with us from Seattle today. Dan Riker joins us in just a moment from California. He's in the thick of all this. You can join us as well. Are you watching the panels go up where you live, on rooftops, by roadways, on hillsides, on deserts? Did you think cheap oil would kill solar? Are you glad it didn't, given the super warm temperatures this weird winter, given global warming and climate change? Can you see solar power becoming a major input to our electrical grid, a real beefy part of our energy mix, or not? Here's a few who've done it. Pat Kennell, retired police officer, Stony Point, New York, installed solar panels on his roof. Talk to CNBC.
I needed to save money. I'm a retired police officer. My wife's 70, and we needed to save some cash, and solar is good for the environment. I expect to save probably 25% off my energy bill.
Good for him if he does. Here's Tyler Felder, Washington, D.C., had solar panels installed. Local government program made free solar panels available for low-income residents. Great if you can get it. Told the Voice of America those panels have drastically cut her bills.
Someone's very excited. I'm very excited. My electric bill has really dropped. The last few months has been like $40 a month.
But government policy and regulation can make a big difference here. Dale Collier lives in Henderson, Nevada, installed solar panels on his home in 2011. It cost him $48,000 to set up the system. That decision, he says, has not paid off as he thought it would because of a change in Nevada's solar incentives.
I had to refinance my house to pay for this. I'm not a rich guy that was like can just write a check for 48 grand. But the long-term plan was it would pay for itself in 8 years.
Things changed. $48,000. David Roberts, that's a lot of money. Is that what people shell out to put panels on the roof?
Well, I mean, it depends obviously on the size of your roof and how sunny the area you live in is, and what sort of business models and financing models are available to you. But yes, the high upfront cost has has long been the main stumbling block to rooftop solar. It's a big capital investment for an individual.
Now, a lot of people are now leasing that equipment, and there's a lot of no money up front deals out there. Are those all over the place or not?
Yeah, no, leasing has absolutely taken off. Leasing is a big reason the rooftop solar industry is booming so much. So, you know, in leasing, you pay nothing up front, and then you pay for the panels out of the savings on your electricity bill. So this is a way of taking that high upfront cost and sort of smearing it over the lifetime of the panels to take that sting out.
Sort of zero down for the utilities. You've said that one of the things they like is that the big commodity energy sources, fossil fuels, can be so erratic in their pricing, but that solar, pretty steady. Describe how that works to earn their interest.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing to remember about coal electricity or natural gas electricity is it depends on the price of a commodity, which is, you know, coal or natural gas. And commodity prices are notoriously volatile. But the fuel cost for solar is free. Sunlight is free. So the only thing you're paying is your upfront capital costs to build the panel, the installation, and then whatever ongoing operation and maintenance, which tends to be pretty modest. You just need to keep the panels clean. So what this means is, because the sunlight is free forever, you can predict exactly how much the power is going to cost out 10 years, 20 years, even 30 or 40 years. So what you're seeing now is utilities signing these power purchase agreements with solar plants saying, you know, we'll take the power that you generate at X rate for the next 25 years. And for utilities, these are extremely, you know, I think as we discussed a second ago, extremely volatile and uncertain times. And so for a utility to be able to know exactly how much it's going to be paying for power for 25 or 30 or 40 years is incredibly, that stability and predictability is worth money. It's like it's risk hedging, basically.
A lot going up in the Southwest, in California, but not only, North Carolina, Georgia, two of the fastest growing states for solar. Turn in just a moment to Dan Riker, who's with the American Council on Renewable Energy. But first, a few of our callers, if I may, David, for you. Alan in Boston. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My wife and I installed 22 solar panels nearly a year ago on our house in Boston.
Great.
And it's paying off for us right away. We've gotten about over $1,000 in state renewable energy credits. Haven't filed my taxes yet, but I'm looking forward to about the $6,000 in federal and about $1,500 in state tax credits. And our electric bill has dropped to zero.
Zero. Are you a very light user of electricity, or you just have that robust solar production?
We're light users. We insulated the house. It's a two-family house, so you know, we're passing some of that down to our tenant, who's paying us for the electricity that she uses.
Yeah.
So it's been a great benefit so far. We paid about $35,000 for the system, and a friend who's putting up not quite as many panels is looking at costs about a third less than what we paid. So it's a great thing. And I just want to note that this is not nearly enough. We need to be doing so much more. The most important thing is that we get fees passed on carbon emissions in the United States. There's a bill pending in Massachusetts right now that's sponsored by Senator Mike Barrett.
So knock back the fossil fuels in a significant way if you really want to change the profile on climate impact. And there's no question about that. It's more than just solar, but it's interesting how rapidly it is all growing out there. David Roberts, stand by in Seattle, Washington. I want to welcome Dan Riker into our conversation from Berkeley, California. He's executive director of the Center for Energy Policy and Finance at Stanford, also professor at the law school there, chair of the board of the American Council on Renewable Energy. Dan Riker, thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
What's your bottom line on why solar is growing so fast right now? Is this aspirational? People want to do something. This is something they can do. Is it really economically driven when there are so many subsidies out there?
Lots of factors, as you just heard from David. This big drop in prices, incentives have helped a lot, mandates in a variety of states. But I think we are getting to a point where we can go beyond mandates, we can go beyond subsidies, and this can increasingly become a mainstream energy source. And that's what's so exciting about it. The real goal here is to get to a point where solar energy can compete straight up in the electricity markets in the United States without that kind of help that we've been talking
about. How far off is that?
Well, the Department of Energy has something called the Sunshot Initiative, which is basically to get us to a point by around 2020 where solar energy can stand on its own 2 feet without any incentives. And we're coming down that pathway pretty well. You hear folks in the solar industry say that when these federal incentives start to run out in 2020, they feel like they can be pretty much cost competitive. So that's the real goal. The more we can come down the cost curves and the more that these technologies can compete straight up.
Are they assuming with that by 2020 fossil fuel prices will be back up, that we're in some kind of lull right now and they'll bounce?
That's the hard part here. I don't think they're assuming that we're going to be back in high fossil fuel prices. I think they feel like, you know, kind of in that middle of the projection for fossil fuel prices, they ought to be pretty competitive at that point.
And what about all this infrastructure being deployed? Are there resources out there to take care of it? Like, who's going to dust all those panels on everybody's house? And when they finally wear out, who's going to take them all down, Dan?
Well, you know, cleaning those panels, the big solar installations in the desert, they actually have robotic cleaning systems. People are encouraged to clean off their ones at home, but a good rainstorm takes care of that pretty well. So, and these systems are designed to last 20, 25, 30 years. So if we're a long way off before people have to start taking them off their roof, and it's a pretty straightforward process to remove them when you have to.
Let me get a call from Marietta, Georgia. Victor is calling. Victor, thank you very much for calling. You are on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered why within our government, since they have millions and millions of square foot of ugly rooftops, why don't they start using more solar panels there? And why don't we encourage more places like Quick Trip, I'm just going past, to go ahead and put some solar panels there? There's whenever you put the solar panels in your subdivision, there's an aesthetic problem there often.
Yep.
But with these businesses and the government, who cares what it looks like?
Victor, I really appreciate your call. Of course, aesthetics are changing here, and there may be a day soon, we read, where building materials themselves have kind of solar panel functionality built into them, so you don't even see it. But Dan, what about the U.S. government and its adoption? What about all those rooftops?
The U.S. government has been pretty aggressive on this front as well. In fact, led by the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon has sent the orders out to the military services, go forth and start deploying renewables in a big way. And actually, the Department of the Navy has been the leader. They each have a goal of 1,000 megawatts of renewables, and they're marching pretty smartly towards that. So I'm actually pretty proud of what the federal government has done. And in terms of the appearance of these things, Tom, to your point, you know, increasingly these are being integrated into building materials. We now have solar roofing shingles. It could go directly into glass. So there's a lot of ways that solar is going to get very much integrated into the buildings that dot the landscape.
David Roberts, you write about that vision. I mean, already some windows have photovoltaic cells, I guess, but the idea of a built environment eventually, where the whole thing would be absorbing. I mean, after all, the sun is the number one energy producer in our vast neck of the woods.
Sure. I mean, if you look at energy sources in terms of their ultimate potential, nothing competes with solar anywhere close. So it's all about getting capital costs down. Once you've unlocked that, you have more or less infinite energy. One thing I wanted to add to the previous questioner, though, Tom, is mm-hmm. that one of the fastest growing segments in the rooftop solar industry is big box stores. Costco, Walmart, you know, places like that are ordering huge solar arrays for their roof, very much on the caller's logic, i.e., it doesn't really matter what things look like up there, and they're saving tons of money.
So just put it up. Brady in Killington, Vermont. Brady, great to have your call. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. Two things. I mean, first of all, I work for the solar company that does all the installations for the DOD, Home Depot, Walmart, et cetera. We're the largest solar installer in the world. And the comment I really want to make is that we have left the nuclear age already. The solar age is now. It's happening. And the new grid is on its way. And the utilities that don't acknowledge what's happening with grid technology are going to die. Green Mountain Power in Vermont is working with SolarCity and Tesla to develop the new grid, which will be where generation, user, storage, and transportation are powered all together without much resistive loss from the grid. And the utility's job will be to manage battery storage and release energy as needed in neighborhoods and groups so that houses have power when their batteries are empty.
You mean the utility, instead of throwing coal in a fire, would essentially be a big battery that would just store and manage what solar and wind created power?
I believe that utilities are going to become battery management companies.
Interesting. Interesting. I appreciate your call, Brady. Dan Riker, does that jive with your anticipation?
Yeah. In fact, in California, our state legislature passed a law which basically said to the big utilities in California to go out and develop increasing amounts of battery storage and get that into the utility system. So Southern California Edison and several of the other utilities in this state are moving fairly aggressively to develop battery storage. And you combine that with other forms of storage, pump storage and a variety of other things, and storage is increasingly going to be a pretty important element of the system. One of the things we need to do is shift the availability of the electricity we make from solar from times when we may have more than we need to times when we don't, for example, when the sun goes down.
So it's all about battery technology advancing.
Battery technology advancing, absolutely. And just like solar prices have been coming down significantly, battery prices are also dropping fast.
David, what are the economics of utilities moving from their current model of being power generators to being, if our caller Brady in Killington's got it right, you know, battery operators, sort of storers and manipulators of energy, a lot of which might be solar produced?
Well, Tom, I got to tell you, that is a Pandora's box of a question, and there's a lot of arguments going on about that right now. But I mean, I think the long story short is the utility business model is going to have to change, and that's not something utilities can really do themselves.
People go to commercial war over things like that.
Yeah, I mean, right now utilities make money the way they're structured to make money, and that sort of puts them intrinsically at odds with rooftop solar. So what's going to happen is legislatures are going to have to take a hand in this. And what you see happening in New York, for instance, New York is absolutely revolutionizing its utilities right now, changing their business model so they can make money doing this sort of battery management and grid management and sort of smoothing, you know, those kind of new world utility jobs. They're orienting the utilities so utilities make money doing that stuff. And that is a battle that's going to be, again, waged in every state, you know, because every state has its own utility rules. But ultimately, utilities can't just decide overnight to embrace this stuff. They have to make money the way they're legislated, you know. They have to do the job they legislated to do. So some of this is going to require root changes in the way utilities operate.
If we should get a change of administration that is opposed to this, I mean, you've got a lot of Republicans who are not big fans and are big fans of the fossil fuel industry. Could it change the fundaments here, the fundament, David?
Well, there are things a hostile administration could do to slow this down. I think at this point it's probably unstoppable, but an administration could scrap the tax credits. You know, Obama's new clean power plan, which is about carbon emissions at power plants, is squeezing a lot of coal plants off the grid, and a new administration could theoretically slow that down or reverse it. But I think at this point, it's all a battle at the margins. At this point, the final outcome of this battle is more or less written already, I think.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about solar energy booming in the warmest winter on record, even with the lowest oil prices in years. David Roberts is with us from Vox.com, covers energy and climate there with us from Seattle. Dan Riker is with us from the Center for Energy Policy and Finance at Stanford, teaches out there, a big role in this whole renewable energy world. Noah Buchheyer joins us in just a moment from Bloomberg Business to look at the fight between Elon Musk of Tesla and Warren Buffett, the famous investor. They've been really tussling big time in Nevada over how solar will be handled. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Is solar the way out of the climate hole we've dug for ourselves, or a significant piece of it? Have you heard about the solar battle between Musk and Buffett over who should pay for solar? A couple of calls and we'll go to Noah, but Jacob in Columbia, South Carolina first. Jacob, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hello, Tom. This is a great show, and I've listened to your program for many, many years, and it is a great show for the public. My question is for Dave, is what happened down the road when you have to replace your roof shingles, and this grid is attached to your roof, and what is the life cycle of the grid system?
That's both great questions. David, you got to climb up there and pull it all down to put up new shingles? How's it work?
You know, honestly, the question of how to get roof shingles underneath your solar panels replaced is something that has never occurred to me. My guess is that solar panels probably protect your roof shingles and extend their life considerably. As Dan said, the panels themselves are expected to last 25 or 30 years, but, you know, early results are coming in on that, and they are lasting, they're proving much more robust in terms of the percentage of their original power that they provide, even after 25 or 30 years, than anyone predicted. So eventually there is going to be a wave of disposal necessary, and that might raise some problems. But as Dan said, that's a long ways off.
Dan, maybe you guys are so high up the ladder that you don't work on the ladder. What do you do about shingles under the solar panels? I mean, after all, the panels don't cover all those shingles. Sooner or later, they wear out. They might not be on the same cycle. And Jacob is fearing having to take the panels down to keep the roof working.
Well, first, you don't want to put the panels on an old roof. If the roofing shingles are soon to give out, that's not a good situation for panels.
Yeah.
And when they do go up, it's fairly straightforward if you have to remove the panels. They're put on racks that can be removed. But, you know, I don't want to kid anybody. That's something you do want to avoid if you can.
Keep a steady eye on that one, Jacob. And I would talk really closely with the installers if you had them out to do some kind of estimate. Let's go to New Jersey, Bridgeton, New Jersey, and Sue. Sue, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to know if anyone out there knows. Of course, a lot of people lose power due to storms. If I had solar installed, and I have these storage batteries, and power lines go down, would I still have power because I have these solar panels, or would I lose both?
Dan, you want to jump on that?
You would likely have power if you had a battery. That's one of the virtues of a battery. I think people make the mistake in thinking that if they simply have the panels on their roof and the power goes out, they're going to have electricity. Often that is not the case.
I assume most people don't have the battery. Most people just have the panels, right?
That's right. Batteries have not been a big seller yet because prices are high, but they are coming down quickly, as we discussed earlier. And you're going to see a lot more battery installations, I think, over the next several years.
Sue, if that certainty of energy is your priority, looks like you better really price out the battery option there. Appreciate your call. Kathleen in Greenfield, Ohio. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Thanks. Hey, I go back and forth from Colorado to Ohio, and I have noticed that the last 5 years or so, maybe more like three, people are having a harder time getting the grants that were available both in Colorado and in Ohio. I have friends who got panels and had help like 15 years ago with grants that they applied for, and I see the same thing in Colorado. Can you talk about, say, Xcel Energy and AEP possibly lobbying? There's a big fight in the Colorado with Xcel and residents, the big energy companies pushing back against, you know, are they undermining the access to these grants by lobbying against them in any kind of way?
We'll pick it up, Kathleen, and I appreciate your call. Dan Riker, big energy companies lobbying on grants, on tax breaks. What's the reality?
There's a real battle over these kinds of support mechanisms, and you do have a fair number of utilities pushing back. Ohio, there's been a battle over their renewable energy standard, and so we are seeing, you know, a reduction in some grants that are available. But you do have other utilities which are supportive. One of your callers was from Vermont. Green Mountain Power is a utility up there that's been quite supportive of moving forward with solar.
Of course, one of the most famous battles, and I don't know if that's going to answer all your questions, Kathleen, but you get the idea. The struggle is going on a lot. One of the biggest arenas for this fight, or one face of it, has been in Nevada, where Warren Buffett, the epic famous investor, and Elon Musk, who of course has founded Tesla and Solar City, which has leased a lot of solar panels, have gone at it. Fighting over regulations and this net metering and who would pay for what when it came to power. Got a little tape here of a man who has a $37,000 solar system on his roof in Nevada. He talked with Bloomberg Business and said he's worried that in Nevada that the battle over solar, Musk versus Buffett, could set a dangerous precedent, he says, for the rest of the country.
There is definitely a much larger issue here than my house. I think it's larger than Nevada. I think if the power company owned by Berkshire Hathaway, essentially controlled by Warren Buffett, can keep their monopoly here, can destroy rooftop solar here, that this is the example or the precedent that they will take to other states across the country, and they will try to kill the competition.
When you hear that Warren Buffett and Elon Musk are fighting, it draws everybody's eye and ear. The cover of Bloomberg Business reporting on this has them sort of as World Wrestling Federation gladiators here going at it hot and heavy. Noah Buchheyer is with us, reporter for Bloomberg Business, also with us today from Seattle. He wrote the piece, Musk versus Buffett, the billionaire battle to own the sun. Noah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's this fight?
Thanks for having me on.
You bet.
Well, you know, we've been talking broadly about this issue in the show so far today. David called it a Pandora's box when you see these new business models, you know, pioneered by entrepreneurs like Elon Musk to help homeowners go solar. When those business models clash with traditional utilities. So what I wanted to do in this piece about Nevada is actually look at two of the actors. And Nevada was very interesting because the traditional utility owner there is Warren Buffett and his company Berkshire Hathaway. And what we've seen in Nevada over the last little stretch here is just a very pitched battle about what these support mechanisms should be for folks who want to go solar. And each side took different tactics. And basically, you know, as you played that tape, the outcome so far has been one that favors the utility. Basically, they rolled back some of the financial incentives that made going solar very attractive for people.
Solar City will come in, and for a 20-year commitment, as you remind us, they set customers up with panels for no money down. Started in California, went into Arizona and Oregon, began selling in Nevada in 2014, very quickly became the state's leading installer of rooftop panels. But that all depended, Noah, on a certain split of in this metering and what the company, the utility, was going to pay for energy that flowed back into the system, right? And what did Buffett say?
Yeah, basically, Buffett's argument, his utility's argument, is that arrangement isn't fair to the million-plus customers in Nevada who haven't gone solar. Basically, they're subsidizing everyone who has gone solar, and that basically was the argument that they took to first the legislature and later the Public Utilities Commission in Nevada, and by and large, the regulators sided with the utility and decided that they were going to begin to pass on higher fees to folks who have rooftop solar.
Here's the billionaire Warren Buffett talking with CNBC's Becky Quick last month. She asked him why his company, Berkshire Hathaway, was, quote, trying so hard to prevent people from converting to solar power in Nevada. Here's Buffett's response.
We do not want our million-plus customers that do not have solar to be buying solar at 10.5 cents when we can turn it out for them at 4.5 cents or buy it at 4.5 cents. So we do not want the non-solar customers, of whom there are over a million, to be subsidizing the 17,000 solar customers.
Yeah, Buffett doesn't want that, and that's his argument, and it's held sway in Nevada. But, of course, this gets very hot in a hurry because people have these on their rooftops and they don't want it changed. Others want to see more solar. Here's a protest in January around all this and over solar.
Solar equals freedom! Solar equals freedom!
Protesters in Nevada, Solar Equals Freedom. Mark Ruffalo, the actor, got involved. He spoke at a rally protesting these changes, criticized the utility company for, as he put it, stealing money from the people who had put solar panels on their roofs.
You're stealing from the people and giving to the rich. You're like the anti-Robin Hood.
Mark Ruffalo. Noah, what were the politics and who got the leverage in here? How in Nevada?
Well, that's what's so fascinating to me about this story in Nevada is that what you've seen on the one hand are solar companies like SolarCity that are basically able to leverage popular opinion in support of their business interests. And what you've seen on the hand in the case of the utilities is they employ lobbyists and they're, you know, fighting this battle through what I would call more traditional channels. They're courting legislators and they're in front of the Public Utilities Commission all the time.
Sure.
For all manner of things. So they're basically fighting this through the traditional regulatory channels, while the solar companies are basically leading these very sort of advocacy-driven campaigns to try and turn public opinion in a way that will help get an outcome that's favorable to their business and also favorable to rooftop solar in general.
I mean, Dan Riker, you're watching this from California and the American Council on Renewable Energy there. You heard the homeowner with a $37,000 system saying that if it goes this way in Nevada, and it has gone this way, that you could see utilities fighting and winning all over the country, turning the tide. What about it, Dan?
Well, let me say this net metering structure has been a very important tool in driving rooftop solar into the mainstream. I actually took advantage of it 20 years ago, putting up a net metered solar system in Washington, D.C.
Paying the homeowner back at a retail rate for whatever that is energy they pitch into the system.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it has been important in bringing solar into the mainstream. You know, I'm hopeful that, you know, we can find a way to keep some key aspects of net metering on the books, but, you know, figure out.
You don't sound
smart.
That hopeful when you say that.
No, I think we can work these things out. I think this is part of a energy system and energy technology growing up. We have battles. You know, go back and look at the even much larger battles we had over nuclear power. When energy systems like this become part of the mainstream, we have fights over their deployment. And this is one of those ones that pits two very different groups against each other. But again, I think there's going to be ways to address these differences. So I'm fairly hopeful that some key aspects of net metering or some variations on net metering will stay on the books. I will say, Hillary Clinton, who's got a strong plan for solar energy, which is to have it get to around 15% of U.S. electrical capacity by the end of 2020, she talks about in her plan, you know, overcoming some of the barriers that prevent low-income and other households from using solar to reduce their monthly energy bills. One of the issues with net metering is, you know, how to bring poorer homeowners into this solar development process. And so we've got to deal with things like that in order to have net metering or some variation on it stay on the books.
David Roberts with Vox there in Seattle, you write about the politics of this being very interesting in solar. I mean, big utilities that go to fossil fuels or coal, a lot of the money goes to the coal mine or the oil well or refinery. But in solar, it gets out in the local community, and then local citizens have it on the roof. They've made investments, and that changes the politics, David.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at Germany's experience, you see how this works. Way back in 2000, Germany passed this policy that encouraged individuals to install solar on the roofs, and millions of individuals started doing it. And what happened was all those millions of individuals became political constituents for further policy. And what you saw and what you see is even when the utilities turn against it, which they have in Germany as well, they hate it there too, they're powerless because the constituency for solar has become so big and loud that it's become effectively unstoppable. And that's what you're seeing now with solar rooftop in the U.S. as well. You've seen it in Nevada.
Noah, we just got a half a minute here, but Elon Musk is not usually a loser or a quiet loser. Is there a Solar City pushback strategy that you can see?
Yeah, absolutely. They're trying to get this issue on the November ballot, and I haven't looked at it recently, but it's going to be a real battle.
So for a popular referendum, to David's point, there it is right there. He's trying to appeal to all those people with panels or wannabe panelists.
Exactly, and people are charged up in Nevada, so I think there's a good chance that it could make it to the ballot.
Watch this space. After the warmest American winter on record, and at a time of record low, or at least lately, low oil and gas prices, solar just goes, and it is interesting how it changes politics, it changes energy supply, obviously, it changes over time, maybe the grid itself, and our individual relationship with energy, people becoming producers. Really a fascinating world, and it's about time. Noah Buchheyer with Bloomberg Business in Seattle, thank you very much for being with us today, Noah.
Thank you.
Musk versus Buffett, the billionaire battle to own the sun, Noah Buchheyer's piece. David Roberts at Vox.com in Seattle, thank you very much for your insights, David.
Thanks, Tom.
And Dan Riker at the Center for Energy Policy and Finance at Stanford, thanks for joining us from Berkeley today, Dan.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Good luck, everybody, with your energy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.